to cover a set curriculum, for instance. Still, most jobs and roles afford you some latitude to change parts of how you work and what you work on. Let's examine two practical tips for how to get started with a redesign where you work. Hunt for pain points. To identify opportunities for redesign, chase pain points, thorny problems plaguing a set of people. Carmen, a 45-year-old business analyst, worked for a New Jersey-based life insurance company. She processed payroll for the company's insurance agents scattered across the country. For years, she helped the agents handle so-called third-party sick pay, don't ask, as they stumbled through the bewildering throng of steps and tax filing implications. Carmen estimated that she received, on average, a phone call each day from an agent irate over the labyrinth of steps required to get through the paperwork. That's a pain point. One day, Carmen decided she'd had enough. She reached out to the company's software coders and got them to help her streamline the enrollment procedure. We took a very confusing industry complexity and turned it into a single user interface screen. It's basically just a few clicks. Everything is sorted out for them. Now, agents log on and within minutes, boom, they're done. As for Carmen, she scored a perfect 7 on the redesigned scorecard and ranked in the top 15% of performers among the 5,000 people we studied. As Carmen's story confirms, pain points are just that, painful. They differ from pleasure points in the way "this sucks" differs from "I want." In Silicon Valley, venture capitalists hunt for startups that aim to cure pain points for the simple reason that customers crave those services. Google's founders Sergey Brin and Larry Page sought to address consumers' deep frustration with inaccurate searches on the Internet. PayPal's founders remedied the agonizing process of wiring money to a stranger online. As the Silicon Valley saying goes, it's easier to sell aspirin than vitamins. What pain points can you spot in your workplace? What do people complain about again and again and again? What gets people confused and frustrated and saying, "This sucks"? Where does work tend to get bogged down? Hunting for pain points is counterintuitive. When we hear people complain, we tend to dismiss them as whiners. Carmen might have grown to resent all those angry insurance agents. Instead, she went beyond her job specification and worked with software coders to create a better setup. As annoying as complainers might sometimes seem, they do us all a service. They identify the pain for free. You can create tremendous value in your job if you spot and help colleagues, customers, and suppliers alleviate their most significant grievances. The more acute the discomfort and the more people suffering from it, the louder they yell, and the greater the prospect for a powerful remedy to create value. Ask stupid questions. Sometimes we fail to imagine great new redesigns because we're trapped inside webs of convention. We only see the current use of a practice, process, or method, for instance. A hammer is used to punch a nail in the wall, and that's what a hammer is for. A classroom in a school is used for teaching, and a teacher in that classroom is used for lecturing in front of the room, and not as a coach helping individual students, as in the case of the flipped classroom. As Dan Pink has argued in his book Drive, we're entrapped by what academics call functional fixedness, our inability to solve problems due to our fixation on how work has always been done. Effective redesign requires that we loosen the shackles of the familiar and ask why things are the way they are and whether there's a better way. To make these discoveries, I recommend that you start asking some stupid why questions. Why do hotels have a reception desk for check-in? Why do we make presentations filled with slides? Why do we call Monday morning staff meetings? Why do kids have 2 months of summer vacation from school? Why do we have to submit expense reports? Why do patients have to spend 2 days in a hospital bed after surgery? Why do we conduct annual performance reviews? Once you've gotten into the habit of asking such questions, ask some what-if questions. What if kids only had 1 month of summer vacation and another month of community service? What if instead of spending 2 days in a hospital bed after surgery, you could go home and have healthcare workers monitor you remotely? What if slide presentations were banned in meetings and replaced by questions to be discussed? The combination of asking a stupid question and crafting some what-ifs can help you discover a nifty redesign and lift your performance. So much of how people work today is old, born at the dawn of the Industrial Revolution. The dreaded performance review dates from at least the 1940s and draws intellectually from Frederick Taylor's work on scientific management during the early 20th century. Ethical codes and other rules of professional conduct originated in the 19th century when modern professions were first taking shape. Technology is now upending many of these conventions, and people are pushing beyond business as usual and questioning how work gets done. The way companies get ahead in such a volatile time is by innovating products and services. The way individuals get ahead is by innovating work. Don't just see yourself as an employee. See yourself as an innovator of work. Hunt and cure pain points. Ask stupid questions and zoom in on how you can redesign and create value for others. People who redesign their work strive to work on the right things and to do them right. Yet the best performers in our research also understood a fundamental insight about change. You can't just jump from one big redesign to another. Once you've made a major change, you have to stick with it and refine it little by little over time. Principal Greg Green understood that switching to the flipped model was just the beginning. Afterward, he and his team had to learn how to operate better within the flipped method day in and day out. But how can you continuously learn and improve while also concentrating on performing your job? That's the topic to which we now turn. Key insights. Redesign your work. The new work harder convention. The more hours people work, the better they perform. Great performance is about delivering on existing goals, tasks, and metrics as defined in one's job description. The new work smarter perspective. If you already work at least 50 hours a week, piling on still more hours won't improve your performance much. It can even make it worse. To achieve great results, redesign work. Upend the status quo and craft new tasks, goals, and metrics that maximize the value of your work. Key points. Our statistical analysis of 5,000 managers and employees demonstrates that those who redesigned their work performed significantly better than those who didn't. According to our statistical analysis, if you work up to 50 hours, performance improves as you add more hours. Beyond 50 hours, the benefit of adding more hours starts to wane. Beyond 65 hours, adding more hours causes performance to decline. Outworking others is not a clever strategy. Good redesigns create more value, the benefits work activities bring to others. That outside-in view is very different from traditional inside-out ways of setting goals, tasks, and metrics. People can achieve their goals and be very productive, yet produce zero value. The value equation emphasizes three distinct components. To produce great value at work is to create output that benefits others tremendously and that is done efficiently and with high quality. Explore 5 ways to redesign work to create value. Less fluff. Eliminate existing activities of little value. More right stuff. Increase existing activities of high value. More gee whiz. Create new activities of high value. 5-star rating. Improve quality of existing stuff. Faster, cheaper. Do existing activities more efficiently. Where to start redesigning your work? You can hunt for and cure pain points, and you can dare to ask stupid questions. Four. Don't just learn. Loop. The arrogance of success is to think that what you did yesterday will be sufficient for tomorrow. William Pollard. On April 5, 2010, 30-year-old Dan McLaughlin of Portland, Oregon, quit his well-paying job as a commercial photographer to devote himself to becoming a professional golfer. He planned to practice the game full-time and to subsist on funds he had saved over the past 5 years. There was just one problem. Dan had never played a full round of the sport and had only been to the driving range a few times. He had never participated in competitive sports beyond a year of high school cross country. Although not exactly a couch potato, he was, in his estimation, much closer to that than to Olympic sprinter Usain Bolt. Was Dan crazy? Dan described his quest as an experiment, an attempt to prove to himself and others that it's never too late to start a new pursuit in life. Having read Malcolm Gladwell's bestseller, Outliers, he had learned that people can master a field with 10,000 hours of practice. And so he crafted the Dan Plan, to practice golf for about 30 hours per week for 7 years to rack up the required hours. 4 years and 5,200 hours later, Dan was on track. He had achieved a handicap of 2.6, which, as any golfer will tell you, is superb. The smaller the number, the better. By comparison, the average male golfer has a handicap of 14.3. Dan's handicap put him in the top 5% of the nearly 24 million golf players in the United States. Dan may never turn pro, but that doesn't matter one bit. He had already accomplished the extraordinary in 4 years. How did he pull it off? Well, he assembled a team of people to support him, including a pro golf instructor, a strength trainer, a personal coach, and a chiropractor. And as you might expect, he also put in a ton of practice. He was out there day after day, month after month, in sweltering heat, pouring rain, and freezing cold, whacking at the ball again and again and again. As our parents and teachers have drilled into us, mastering a skill means repeating it endlessly. Practice makes perfect, right? Wrong. The secret isn't repetition. The idea that it takes 10,000 hours of practice to master a skill is misleading. 1 year of practice repeated in the same way for 10 years doesn't make perfect. Rather, a certain kind of practice makes perfect. Professor K. Anders Ericsson of Florida State University and his colleagues have studied how people achieve mastery in music, science, and sports. As Ericsson and Robert Poole discuss in their book, Peak, two factors contribute to mastery. Hours of repetition, yes, but more important, what Ericsson coined, deliberate practice. Individuals who progress the most meticulously assess outcomes, solicit feedback based on known standards of excellence, and strive to correct tiny flaws that the feedback has uncovered. This purposeful and informed way of practicing explains why some learn at a much faster rate than others. Dan devoted himself to such deliberate practice. When he measured his golf swings and where the ball landed, he was meticulous. It wasn't just a little to the left of the hole, but 11 feet to the left. He knew what percentage of his shots went down the fairway, 40.9%, what percentage missed going left, 31%, and what percentage missed going right, 28.1%. He tracked his driving accuracy for each round of golf, and he graphed his recovery performance, 41.5% scrambling and 23.5% sand saves. He used sophisticated 3D technology at a facility outside Atlanta to capture a three-dimensional scan of his movements. Sharing this information with his coach, he obtained precise feedback and concrete suggestions for the next swing. Widen your stance by 1 inch, the coach might say. Dan also tracked his progress by monitoring one key performance metric, his handicap score. As a result, Dan's practice sessions benefited him far more than they would have had he merely repeated his swing over and over and relied on vague metrics. As he told us in our interview for our study, Dan encountered many other golfers who practiced in this less thoughtful way, just hitting the ball over and over. They didn't concentrate so hard on what they were doing, and they didn't make much progress. Dan made every minute of practice time count. It was this quality of learning and not the quantity of repetitions that helped Dan achieve that 2.6 handicap in 4 short years. Given the impressive feats that top performers in sports, music, chess, and spelling bees have achieved using deliberate practice, you would think that legions of employees in the working world would rely on this approach to master their job-specific skills. Yet most individuals don't. Companies have long deployed improvement techniques such as Six Sigma, and a whole field called organizational learning has arisen to help businesses improve quality in manufacturing, logistics, customer ordering, and service. Yet this approach has not expanded much outside such organizational processes, and it is not filtered down to individual employees. If you glance around the workplace, you'll find that few people strive to enhance their skills the way Dan enhanced his golf game. As a result, people conduct meetings or give presentations or make sales pitches just as they've always done. They become good enough, but not great at work. Employees who wish to practice skills at work face some challenges. Experts haven't articulated how people can use a continuous learning technique like deliberate practice in their daily work. And most organizations aren't geared to support such techniques. Take performance reviews. Deliberate practice requires that a manager or employee receives helpful feedback every day, yet most people only receive it during their annual review. Imagine the tennis great Roger Federer getting feedback on his serve once a year from his coach. "Hi, Roger, I've been observing your serve for a year now, and I think you should serve a tad more to the left next year." Absurd. Still, that's what we do at work. Deliberate practice is also incompatible with the realities of today's hurried workplaces. The idea of practice in sports and the arts entails rehearsing exhaustively before the real performance, a concert or competition. But most employees struggle to set aside their regular work to rehearse skills. They're too busy. Athletes also have an easier time measuring outcomes than employees. Dan can track the exact movement of his golf swing and where the ball lands, 11 feet to the left. But how do you measure skills like prioritizing tasks, making a sales pitch, handling a customer complaint, writing an effective email, and listening in meetings? For these reasons, some experts don't recommend deliberate practice for individuals at work. As Professor Erickson notes, deliberate practice only helps in situations where a performer possesses a clear performance metric and where he or she knows the skills required to perform well and can break them down into discrete steps. What areas don't qualify? He writes. Many of the jobs in today's workplace, business manager, teacher, electrician, engineer, consultant, and so on. I respectfully disagree. Deliberate practice translates far better to the workplace than we might think. But there's a crucial twist. As we discovered in our research, we can't just take deliberate practice and copy and paste it into the workplace. Instead, we must implement a different version, what I call the learning loop. Employees and managers who improve their skills at work follow several tactics that you don't find in traditional deliberate practice as deployed in the performing arts and sports. They discard isolated practice in favor of learning as they work, using actual work activities such as meetings or presentations as learning opportunities. They also spend just a few minutes each day learning, eschewing the 3 to 4 hour practice sessions common among musicians and athletes. They also rely on informal, rapid feedback from peers, direct reports, and bosses, and not just coaches. And they take steps to measure the softer skills that permeate the workplace. As I will detail, people embracing the learning loop follow 6 highly effective tactics geared specifically to the workplace. People in our 5,000-person study who adopted the learning loop performed much better than those who didn't. We created a learning loop scorecard consisting of 6 items that included phrases such as makes changes in an effort to improve, tries out new approaches, learns from failures, is curious, doesn't believe he or she knows best, and experiments a lot. We found a clear result. Effective learners were likely to place 15 points higher in our performance ranking than the less effective ones. Say a salesperson is currently performing in the top 20% among all the salespeople in her company. By mastering the learning loop, she would climb to the top 5%, emerging as an outstanding sales rep. The top learners in our study didn't master their skills by working crazy hard and repeating the same habits over and over again. They worked, on average, 48 hours per week, only 1 hour more than the ordinary learner. Instead, they worked smart by focusing on the quality of each of the loops when learning at work. To understand how they might have done so, let's look in detail at one individual in our study who sought to improve her job skills, constantly reviewed how she worked, learned from failures, and became a top 10% performer as a result. Looping at work. Brittany Gavin, a food and nutrition services supervisor at Scripps Memorial Hospital in La Jolla, California, had just finished a meeting when her phone rang. It was her boss, telling her that a patient was furious about the quality of his lunch. "Oh, no," Brittany said. "Not another one." Her team served meals to patients, employees, family members, and visitors. Laboring over hot stoves and in back storerooms, her 22 frontline employees made sure that patients at the 432-bed facility got the nourishing food they needed. Yet, in recent months, the team had underperformed. Patient satisfaction scores were disappointing, and employee engagement was average at best. Almost every week, Brittany had to trek over to a patient's room to apologize for the quality and taste of the food her team served. Brittany had worked in her supervisory job for about a year and a half. Given her department's poor performance, she was starting to question whether management was something she could even do. She remained highly motivated, yet she felt at a disadvantage. Her undergraduate degree was in nutrition, not business management. She knew her way around an institutional kitchen, but sensed she had considerable room to improve as a boss. One area of management in particular stymied her, fostering problem-solving skills among people on her team. Every day, her team members plodded through the same routine, contenting themselves with maintaining the status quo rather than improving. There wasn't much innovation or idea generation, she said. Yet Brittany didn't know how to prompt others to propose ideas for improvement. Like many managers, she felt more comfortable simply offering her own solutions to problems as they arose. Brittany needed to learn a new skill: how to run idea sessions with her team, where she would ask questions to solicit opportunities for improvements, OFIs, from team members reluctant to speak up. When she first started to run such sessions, the conversations with staff went nowhere. At 10:45 a.m. staff meetings with her team, called huddles, Brittany asked questions like, "Do you have any concerns about your work?" Usually people just stared back at her or mumbled no. Brittany couldn't fathom how to ask questions and spark a discussion so that people would open up and contribute. She enrolled in a formal Scripps training program and then set about applying the tactics she had learned. During a huddle with staff one morning in February 2015, Brittany tried a new approach to asking questions. Whereas before she had asked, "Do you have any ideas?" she now posed that question differently. What ideas do you have to improve patient food service? Her coaches, Steve and Marlis, had suggested that such a seemingly trivial change would invite people to suggest ideas. And sure enough, one staff member responded. How about we start knocking on the door and introduce ourselves to patients and saying we're from meal services? Okay, that was a measurably better outcome. An idea. Brittany responded, okay, great. And then the session went silent. Oops, not such a great outcome after all. In a debrief later that day, Coach Steve asked how she could have done it differently, and Brittany said she struggled with the follow-up question. They came up with a modified plan to ask better second questions. With this bumbling try at posing a question, Brittany had just completed her first learning loop. She tried a new approach to asking questions, do, gauged the outcome of soliciting an idea, measure, received analysis and suggestions from Steve to follow up, feedback, and altered her plan to ask a second question, modify. These basic steps feature in any behavioral learning model, but they differ in some fundamental ways from how Dan the golfer performed them. Brittany's desired skill was more abstract than Dan's, generating ideas in her team versus swinging the club in observable movements. Her desired outcome was more difficult to measure, whether staff proposed good ideas versus ball landed 11 feet to the left of hole. And constructive feedback was harder to come by. Change the question versus widen your stance by 1 inch when swinging the club. Brittany's deviations from Dan's deliberate practice method underscored the challenges inherent in learning while working. She broke down the abstract skill she sought into a specific behavior, asking a good question. She measured her behavior by zooming in on two metrics, number of ideas proposed and implemented. She received constructive feedback by working closely with a coach, while also receiving feedback from her team. And she only spent a few minutes each day focusing on learning. The following week, Brittany held another huddle where, again, she asked the question, "What ideas do you have for improving patient service?" A staff member suggested, "How about asking patients before we leave what else we can help them with?" Brittany followed up with, "Okay, great. When can you start doing that?" Another staff member mumbled, "Whenever we can," and that was it. Oops, not such a good outcome either. In the debrief, Coach Marlis suggested that she needed to ask people explicitly to get involved. So again, Brittany modified her plan, completing her second learning loop. In a huddle a few weeks later, she again posed the question, "What ideas do you have for improving patient service?" Staff members were now more excited and proposed more ideas, including, "How about we plan better to avoid out-of-stock items?" Brittany responded, "That's interesting. Let's get together this week in a smaller group to work on that, okay?" Which they did. In the debrief, Coach Steve praised her improvements, and they planned the next modification. In this third loop, she finally mastered the art of soliciting ideas and ensuring a commitment from staff to follow through. And so it went, with Brittany addressing many issues over a couple of dozen learning loops. Her boss, too, joined the huddles from time to time and provided feedback. Brittany learned to spend less valuable meeting time on announcements implemented in a learning loop, to talk less about the data and more about how to solve problems, another learning loop, to ask employees how she as a manager might support them, another learning loop, to follow up on previously discussed ideas, another learning loop, and so on. Brittany displayed humility during all of this learning, with her boss awarding her a top mark in our learning scorecard on the statement, "Doesn't believe she knows best." She also learned from her failures, which was an important part of her effort to improve. In our learning loop scorecard, her boss gave Brittany the top score, completely agree, on the statement, "Is excellent at learning well from failures to avoid repeating the same mistakes." Only 17% of people in our 5,000-person data set scored this high. Almost half scored low or very low, suggesting that many people can benefit from becoming better at learning from their failures. Observing Brittany's progress, we find that it's the quality of each of these loops that helped her improve, and not their sheer number. Imagine what might have happened had she attempted an endless series of repetitions with no learning from failures, no feedback, and minimal modifications. She would have invested a great deal of hard work, but progressed very little. Learning on the job is not about practicing for 10,000 hours. It's about making sure you perform each loop with high quality. Brittany saw exceptional progress from her effort. We asked her boss to rate her performance before and after she embarked on the learning loop. Before the effort, her boss ranked her in the top 30% of her peer group. After 18 months of looping, Brittany moved up to the top 10% in her peer group, receiving a rating of outstanding. Her team's performance also improved. Staff suggested 104 opportunities for improvements during a 13-month period, and they implemented 84. These improvements, posted on a public board every week in the department for all to see, included: insert a barrier at the bottom of trash cans to reduce the volume of trash placed in it. This prevented back injuries among staff. Create a floor stocking process with times when each item would be stocked, thus ensuring that food items are in stock if patients require them between formal mealtimes. Revise the way milk is retrieved from the facility's walk-in cooler so that it remains cold as meals are assembled. As Brittany noted, the way she learned to ask questions made all the difference in helping her team generate all these ideas. And the 84 ideas that were implemented affected critical outcomes. Patient satisfaction with food temperature, food quality, and the courtesy of staff members all rose. The number of products out of stock in the department plummeted from 22 per week to 6. Employee back injury incidents fell from 5 to 0. Employee engagement scores rose from 63 to 98. Brittany no longer doubted whether she could become a good manager. She'd proven she could. In improving her skills, Brittany enjoyed the support of her boss and her coaches, but what if you lack that? We've found that people can apply the learning loop even in situations where there is no official support. As Brittany's journey and other cases in our study revealed, people who learned well while working followed 6 smart work tactics. Looping tactic number 1. Carve out the 15. You might look at Brittany's skills development and think, man, this type of learning is hard work. I don't have that kind of time. Yes, looping requires effort. Brittany's boss, for example, gave her a top score on our survey statement, "She constantly reviews how she is working and makes changes in an effort to improve." Only 11% of the 5,000 participants in our study received this high score, while another 26% scored a tad lower. One-third scored low. Most of Brittany's learning took place in the course of her daily work, not during formal training. Her job was to lead those huddles and implement ideas for improvements in her department. The coaching and looping required some additional time, but not much. Brittany's coaching sessions were about 30 minutes long. Since she didn't receive coaching every day, the extra time spent working on her skill averaged about 15 to 20 minutes per day. As I found in my consulting activities and in my own experience, it takes about 15 minutes of work time every day to improve a skill using the learning loop. Some time ago, I sought to improve my public speaking. I applied the learning loop in the course of delivering keynote speeches at conferences. All these keynotes, they were my real job. To apply the learning loop, all I had to do was record the event, study a few segments of the recording while on the plane home each time, ask someone to watch parts of it for 10 minutes, and then receive feedback about the one behavior I tried to improve. In all, I invested 30 minutes of extra work on each keynote I delivered, 15 minutes per day for a 2-day trip. It is that constant yet brief effort that counts. Can you really hammer out significant progress by devoting just 15 minutes a day? Yes, so long as you stick to the power of one. Pick one and only one skill at a time to develop. It's hard to master a skill if you're also working on 10 others. Just think of all the behaviors we cover in this book. Imagine an employee sauntering into work one morning and telling himself, "Today I am going to prioritize more, find a new task that delivers more value, infuse my work with passion, inspire my coworkers, and foster debate in our morning meeting." He wouldn't have time to do them well. Ask yourself, which skill would, if improved, lift your performance the most? Choose that one to work on first and devote 15 minutes a day. Yes, just 15. Looping tactic number 2. Chunk it. To start improving a skill, effective learners in the workplace break it into manageable chunks, what I call micro-behaviors. A micro-behavior is a small, concrete action you take on a daily basis to improve a skill. The action shouldn't take more than 15 minutes to perform and review, and it should have a clear impact on skill development. Brittany broke her overall skill area of getting the team to generate ideas into the micro-behaviors of asking a question that gets people to propose an idea, asking a follow-up question that generates more detail, and securing follow-up commitment from team members, among others. I broke my improving keynote speaking skill into a few areas: opening, closing, stage movement, punchline on each slide, and used the power of one to work on each. For stage movement, I worked on start by planting your feet like cement on the floor versus moving restlessly like a caged tiger. Move a few steps, then stop again. Make eye contact with one person, then move to another, and extend your arms outward to claim space. These actions might seem trivial, but I could go on stage and remember to do just one of them at a time. They were concrete and actionable. In a leadership development program I have been running for the Scandinavian media company Schibsted, we tackle the tough but common challenge: getting managers to embrace and implement the company's leadership competencies on a daily basis. Many companies articulate such competencies, yet people often fail to embrace them. Schibsted adopted 12 leadership competencies, including cultivate speed and flexibility, execute and follow through to results, no excuses, and insist on fact-based decisions. Although managers understood these formulations, they needed to translate these into daily concrete actions. To help them do so, we crafted 10 micro-behaviors for each competence. Managers completed 360 assessments to identify their specific areas of development. They then used the power of one to pick one and only one competence at a time. To help them, we developed a smartphone app that each week sent them 2 micro-behaviors they could use while working. For example, Bård Viken, a 31-year-old manager in charge of online subscriptions in Norway, elected to work on executing and following through to results, no excuses. On Monday at 8 a.m., as Bård was walking into the office, his phone lit up with a notification, and a micro-behavior appeared on his smartphone. Today, approach one employee where you think there may be an issue with prioritization and have a brief conversation to make sure that the most important tasks are the first priority. Bård blocked off 10 minutes in the afternoon to talk with 2 of his direct reports about the need to prioritize. During this brief conversation, Bård reminded his reports that their top priority at the moment was to get quick results on a pressing issue: how to prevent online customers from leaving. Over 5 weeks, Bård received 9 more micro-behaviors on this competence, including make it a habit to complete one task before moving on to another. Look at your list of tasks and pick one that you will definitely finish soon before starting new ones. And make sure that you're not slowing others down. Check your messages right now for a pending question from a colleague who needs your response and answer it. By practicing these micro-behaviors, Bourde could translate the abstract principle of executing and following through to results into specific daily actions. His skills improved in turn. Looping tactic number 3. Measure the soft. When you're on a diet, you can monitor what you eat and hop on the scale every morning. K. Anders Ericsson's studies on deliberate practice likewise focused on measurable activities. In their book Peak, Robert Poole and Ericsson describe a man who used deliberate practice to memorize a string of 82 random digits. I can hardly remember a 10-digit phone number. Imagine memorizing 82. As impressive as that was, this memory whiz had it easy in one respect. Measuring the outcome of each attempt was straightforward. When trying to repeat back 82 numbers in the right order, he knew immediately whether he got it right or wrong. It is much more difficult to measure soft professional skills, such as listening in meetings or prioritizing a list of responsibilities. To solve this problem, you can measure microbehaviors associated with softer skills, as well as the result of those microbehaviors. Brittany couldn't easily measure the overall quality of the daily discussions she was leading, but she could measure whether she was implementing the microbehavior of asking specific questions, such as, "What ideas do you have?" rather than less effective questions, such as, "Do you have any ideas?" She could also track the outcome of this microbehavior, noting how many ideas employees proposed and whether they agreed to a follow-up. In our era of big data, measuring soft behaviors has become easier. We flock to internet sites like Yelp to rate our doctors, plumbers, electricians, and lawyers. If you're a dermatologist looking to improve your patient-oriented behaviors, you might already have access to a trove of data. Of course, some of that might be biased. Ours is also the era of the quantified self. We enjoy access to a raft of tools designed not merely to help us track fitness goals, but to help us home in on what we do well or poorly at work. The downside is that it's easy to become overwhelmed with all this data. The work harder paradigm would have you amass reams of data on all kinds of work activities. That's wrong. Ask yourself, which one or two metrics will, if tracked, make a big difference in my efforts to improve my work performance? Brittany, for example, zoomed in on opportunities for improvements, OFIs, submitted, and implemented and tracked those over time. Looping tactic number 4. Get nimble feedback fast. Measurement and feedback often go together. But be careful. The quality of feedback matters. It's easy enough to assign a restaurant 4 stars on Yelp and type in a comment recommending the General Tso's chicken. Useful feedback, however, requires more than a simple rating. It includes information about how well a person did and suggestions for how to modify behaviors. As Financial Times columnist Lucy Kellaway wrote, "Great post and spot on do not help me write better, any more than I can't believe you get paid to write this drivel." Likewise, "the meeting sucked" is not going to help you run better meetings. But a comment like, "the debate in the meeting was superficial, ask more specific questions next time," delivers both an assessment, "it didn't go so well," and a helpful tip. For best results, experts, a coach, boss, or mentor, might scrutinize an employee's behavior and provide immediate feedback with suggestions for improvement. However, relying on experts is much harder in workplace settings than it is out on the athletic field or in a music conservatory. In companies, most formal feedback is sporadic, mainly annual, and coaches are rarely available. What can you do if, unlike Brittany at Scripps, you don't have access to a coach? You can turn to technology. The app we developed for Bourde Vikan at Schibsted allowed him to request nimble 140-character feedback from peers. At the end of the week, having approached his employees and reminded them to prioritize the online customer migration problem, Ford clicked on the app to request feedback from them and two other employees. "I'm working on setting clearer expectations," he wrote. "I worked on clearly communicating priorities. Did it help? One thing I can do better?" The first brief feedback he received within a day was, "Communication was clear, but it is important that you walk the talk." 68 characters. Another one, "Clear improvement, but take the time needed with your team to define what should be done and measured." 104 characters. His team used the app to give him rapid, honest, and constructive feedback. Each team member needed only a minute to share his or her opinions and advice. No coach needed. Assessing their feedback, Ford realized that he himself often failed to follow through on the most important initiatives. This feedback prompted him to prioritize time to help his team on this important issue. In lieu of such an app, you can use email or texting. You could even go old school, sticking your head into a colleague's office and asking for 30 seconds of feedback on how the meeting went. Looping tactic number 5. Dig the dip. Fertility doctors have a choice when patients visit their office. They can screen for and refuse the most difficult cases. Those patients include women who are more than 35 years old, who have a low egg count, and who have already tried in vitro fertilization without success. Excluding these high-risk cases boosts the doctor's success rate, the proportion of patients who ultimately give birth, which in turn burnishes the doctor's reputation. Refuse the tricky patients and you can perform better. Yet there's a snag. If you never take on challenging cases, you won't learn anything new, and you won't improve. Professors Mihaela Stan of University College London and Freek Vermeulen at the London Business School gathered data from 116 British clinics whose doctors had treated 300,000 women from 1991 to 2006. They distinguished between clinics and doctors that had treated only easy cases and those that had also accepted difficult cases. Sure enough, clinics and doctors that mainly treated easy patients boasted a 10% higher success rate, enough to steer more patients toward their practices. Ah, but wait. What happened over time? If you treat difficult patients, your performance dips in the short term because it is harder to help those patients, but you can also expand your knowledge. As one doctor in their study remarked, "When you get a difficult case with complex pathology, you change the practice. You start tinkering with the parameters, adding new things, adjusting doses and sequences so that it fits. Moreover, you can use wisdom gained from the complicated cases to treat more straightforward cases with greater insight." Said the doctor, "You start tinkering with the procedure for the easy case as well. You take what you've learned from that difficult case to the easy case." That's indeed what happened. Over time, doctors who treated tough cases went on to excel. For a clinic's first 100 cases, doctors who stuck with less complicated patients enjoyed a higher success rate. After 100 cases, doctors who had treated more difficult patients all along snuck into the lead because benefits from their learning kicked in. At 400 cases, their success rates surpassed those of the easy case doctors by 3.3%, and their learning continued. Their looping had made them the top performers. Quality management techniques in companies urge employees to eliminate the defects and waste that cause performance to vary. These techniques seek to drive out variation and failure. That's a grave mistake. Variation, trying new ideas, is essential to learning, and tackling difficult problems can provide rich learning opportunities. People who pursue the learning loop typically see their performance dip over the short term as they introduce challenges and experiment with ways to solve them. But they realize gains over time. The challenge, then, is to learn to tolerate failure in the short term. A number of people in our study possessed healthy attitudes toward failure. Christy, a financial analyst at a Dallas insurance company, told us that the more mistakes she makes, the more I actually learn about what's technically going on and all the aspects involved in the accounting that I do. When she encounters a new problem, I have better ideas of where to start and how to face that problem. If you expect perfection each time, you won't take a chance on risky patients, or on a new and challenging client, or on a different way to make a sales pitch. You'll think, what if it goes wrong? You'll stymie your own growth. Our 5,000-person study revealed a yawning gap in people's inclination to experiment. A full 32% scored low on the question, I often try out new approaches to see if they work. Only 11% scored high on that metric. The people in our study who dared to risk a short-term performance dip reaped performance benefits. Statistically, we found a strong positive association between experimentation and excellent performance. Now, there is a smart and a dumb way to experiment. When trying out an idea, you don't want to take big risks. If you do, you won't just see a dip, you'll fall off a cliff. As we saw in the previous chapter, Principal Greg Green started small when trying to flip the education method at Clintondale High School. Rather than flipping the whole school, he piloted his new approach in one social studies class. He retained the old method for the other class and then compared the results. That's called A-B testing. You test your new idea on group A and then compare it to the control group, B. If the flipped social studies class had fared poorly, Green could have just dropped the flipping idea. Once Green understood the new model's power, thanks to a few more experiments, he went all in and flipped the whole school. By first experimenting, Green took a smaller risk and gathered evidence that would support a subsequent, more ambitious redesign. Looping tactic number 6. Confront the stall point. Magnus Carlsen is no ordinary chess player. Born and mainly raised in a small Norwegian town, he started playing seriously at age 8. By 13, he had become the second youngest grandmaster ever, and by 19, the youngest chess player in history to rank number 1 in the world. 2 years later, he hit a peak rating of 2,882 points, the highest ever achieved, surpassing the great Russian champion Garry Kasparov. In 2013, at age 23, he won the world championship in chess. He defended it the following year and again in 2016. Carlsen is Exhibit A for inborn talent. He has a gift for the game and has been held up as a counterpoint to those who believe that anyone with enough practice can achieve greatness. His fellow grandmasters proclaim him a genius. You and I will never reach Carlsen's level in chess, even if we practice 100,000 hours, let alone 10,000. Playing chess taps into his natural strengths. But there's more to Carlsen than merely his chess genius. We can't just compare him to ordinary people and say that he has a super talent they lack. We must also compare him to other chess masters and ask why Carlsen outperforms them. After all, they too are prodigies. When we delve deeper into Carlsen's career, we find that he outplays his peers in part because he brings a unique learning attitude. After becoming world champion in 2013, he said, "I am still far away from really knowing chess, really. There is still much I can learn, and there is much I still don't understand. And this makes me motivated to keep going, to understand more and more and develop myself." Really? You're the best chess player on earth, yet you say you don't really know chess? That's one humble learner. Carlsen clearly subscribes to Stanford professor Carol Dweck's growth mindset theory, even though he may not know about her work. In Dweck's theory, those who believe that you either have talent or not, a fixed mindset, don't bother to improve much, while those who believe that talent is malleable, a growth mindset, put in extra effort, even when they excel at something. Carlson's mindset to keep pushing and improving, regardless of his past achievements, prevented him from falling into a common trap, the stall point. As people develop expertise and skill in an activity, they can become very good, even excellent. But then, something happens. They plateau. A large-scale study in North Carolina, for example, showed that teachers improved from 0 to 2 years of teaching experience, but then stalled. Teachers with 27 years of experience, that's more than 40,000 hours of practice, were not much more effective than those with 2 years in improving students' achievement, as measured by their proficiency in English and math. So much for the 10,000-hour rule. People seek out new improvements, but only until they reach a certain level of satisfaction. Then they stop, judging themselves good enough. The Nobel laureate in economics, Herbert Simon, termed this satisficing, a play on words that combined satisfying and sufficing. Why do so many people stall upon becoming good enough? Researchers have found that many of us automate our skills. At first, we might struggle to develop a sales pitch. Now, we can do it in our sleep. So we do. We let skills that once required fierce effort lapse into habits. Sometimes that is a good thing. We couldn't function if we had to contemplate every last action during our workday. But the moment a behavior becomes automatic, our learning stalls. Unless, that is, you take a tip from Magnus Carlsen and constantly push the boundaries, even when you're on top. The top performers in our study followed Carlsen's dictum. A whopping 74% of the top performers in our data set constantly reviewed their work in an effort to learn and improve. That compares with only 17% of people in the underperforming category. Top performers don't rest. They keep learning. Remember Jiro, the sushi chef from Chapter 2? At age 85, he was still pushing himself. "All I want to do is make better sushi," he said in the film. "I do the same things over and over again, improving bit by bit. Even at my age, after decades of work, I don't think I have achieved perfection." How do you avoid becoming obsolete? In this and the previous chapter, we've discussed how you can improve performance by redesigning your work and how you learn. Yet there is another reason to redesign and implement the learning loop. You also adapt better to changes in the workplace. In many industries, new technologies have ushered in innovative working methods and automation. Graphic design has disrupted the work of newspaper typesetters. Voicemail and smartphones have eliminated many secretarial jobs. Online travel sites have displaced travel agents. Robots have gnawed away at traditional factory jobs. These are punctuated changes. They rupture the fabric of work and make skills irrelevant. As such disruption continues, you might need to innovate the way you work so as to stay relevant and keep your job. Here are some tactical solutions to help you get over hurdles that prevent you from looping. If you're too busy with work to deal with training and practice, then carve out just 15 minutes per day of your time and focus on one key skill at a time, the power of one. If you don't know where to start, it's too difficult to improve a broad skill like prioritize better, then chunk it. Breaking your desired skill into small, concrete, daily micro-behaviors. You don't know how to measure the outcome of what you're doing. For instance, how do you know you're listening better in a meeting? Then focus on tracking micro-behaviors. If you're working on listening better, did you make eye contact with the person who was speaking? Yes or no? If your annual performance review doesn't give you feedback when you need it, it's too sporadic, then solicit nimble feedback, brief, informal, instant comments from peers. No bloated surveys. If you're afraid to try new ways of working that may fail and you think you're doing just fine with your current setup, then conduct small experiments to limit any downside and then implement those that work. If you've gotten comfortable in your routines and are no longer making much progress, then push beyond stall points by de-automating your routines. The best performers adapt successfully to disruptions by combining redesign and the learning loop. In their seminal study, professors Amy Edmondson, Richard Bomer, and Gary Pisano at the Harvard Business School chronicled how a few